At the end of your life, what will be your legacy? What will you leave behind for future generations? For the world, join the world messenger, Isabella Lundberg. Each week as she brings you a new distinguished guest from the business, sports, or entertainment world to share their success, their struggles, and their lessons. They will share their insights into current hot topics that affect everyone. Isabella facilitates an intimate, vulnerable environment to find the true value of humanity and real leadership. Are you ready for your legacy? The legacy that matters?
Hello, hello, my beautiful friends. It's Isabella Lombacura, the World Messenger, and I'm inviting you for another epic episode of Legacy Leader Show. I am absolutely stoked, and I cannot wait to introduce you to today's guest that is joining me from the Cheese City, Chicago, and it's one of the top global security executives who is serving Fortune 100 and also high net worth individuals, who is also published author and leader on leadership, kindness, and risk management, one of my favorite topics, which I cannot wait to hear how he's blending and making this happen, as well, obviously, trusted advisor, international keynote speaker, veteran, who served internationally and who also had very interesting story and personal background that I cannot, again, wait for Tim himself, Tim Wenzel, to share firsthand. Tim, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Isabella. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Obviously, Tim, this introduction is not doing justice, but given how much you already accomplished, where you've been, and how you were effectively able to mold yourself in, obviously, the trajectory and the path where you are today. But before it starts, I'm sure there's some really cool story. What happened in your early upbringing and childhood that you recognize not only you want to put yourself in high-risk situations, but also be able to do things differently?
Yeah, that's a good place to start, I suppose, at the beginning. So I grew up in rural Illinois, really a small town in the middle of the cornfield. And I grew up very bored. I grew up very dissatisfied with my surroundings. Even at 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, I already knew that there was no future for me there. Everybody was telling me what their view of what my life would look like was. So I never did well in school. I was completely bored with school. My teachers would tell me, well, you're pretty bright, Tim, but you don't really follow the rules. So you're probably going to be like a construction worker or maybe a painter like your dad. And I was like, no. My idea for me was I was going to be involved in something epic, change the world, be involved in world events. And I was always drawn to the group of old men at the diner. They were wearing their ball caps that said that they were a Vietnam veteran, a World War II veteran, you know, Desert Storm. And I was like, wow, like those guys look awesome. And I'd always try to get a seat next to their table so that while we were eating, I could hear what they were talking about. And the stories that they had just seemed to just not only tell the story of history, but the story of a life lived for something greater than themselves. And so really, from the time I was probably 7, 8 years old, I said, I'm going to be in the military. I'm going to be a part of history. And hopefully I can do something worthwhile, something greater than myself. And so that led to me being a pretty angry kid, always frustrated, always getting involved in like little fights at school, getting beat up on the bus sometimes, just generally upset with my surroundings, to the point when I enlisted in the National Guard, I was 17. I was still a junior in high school. I was going to go to my basic training that summer, come back for my senior year, and then I was going to go to Fort Sam Houston for Army Medic School after I graduated. So I needed my parents' permission, and they gave their permission. But my mom and dad told me, they said, you know what, Tim? We're very fearful that you're going to end up in like military prison because you're so angry. we're afraid you're going to do something stupid. So if you start there, and this kid with anger issues, kind of known for being angry, loved violence, absolutely loved violence. I read all the gun magazines. I would watch all the fights on TV. Whenever people would be fighting around me, I was like so excited. And I could see, especially if I grew up these days, I'd probably be in juvenile hall. they'd probably send me away because I can see how that would be a pretty scary childhood for a parent to witness. But how does that turn into someone who's a protector of others? And then fast forward to my mid-30s, somebody who's a massive proponent of kindness, leading with kindness, infusing your entire sphere of influence with kindness. And actually, Leighton and I, we think that leading with kindness is most likely the strongest, most scalable leadership philosophy ever, because it's a choice that you can make over and over and over again to leave every life scenario a little bit better than you found it.
I love that full circle, and I'm sure everybody watching and listening are now on the edge to hear more, because it's great to know when we are really not meant to be in an environment that we're meant to, that we outgrow that. And I can share that consensus with you, because I felt the same about my upbringing, and understanding that I wanted to explore and do things differently. And I also don't want to be necessarily measured based on someone else's work or who they are, and then just to be kind of put in that position. But I love what you did at that moment. Obviously, you made a choice and decision. And now question is, how that got you where you are today? So what happened when you joined the military? You have to tell us.
Well, so I joined the military, went to Army Medic School. So I'm in the National Guard, so I'm part-time. And so full-time, I was working at hospitals and working on the ambulance as an EMT. And this is kind of a weird little detail to my story, but it ends up being massive. So I was a phlebotomist at a hospital working out of their laboratory, drawing blood. And one of the duties of the phlebotomist was cleaning up the morgue after autopsies.
Ooh.
So I'm the only male phlebotomist. And if you can't guess, the females hated this dirty job. And it was kind of gross. And so basically, if I was on shift, they were like, hey, will you do this? Like, I'll pay you to do this. Like, please just go and do this. I know you do this every day. But it never really bothered me too much, because I was already working on the ambulance. I was already around that type of stuff. And the pathologist took notice that, one, I was always in the morgue, helping them clean up, get set up. Two, I was an EMT trending towards becoming a paramedic. I was an Army medic. And they said, you know what, Tim? You can never be truly great at healing people if you don't understand how they die. And so they made me the morgue manager at 19 years old. And basically, they started calling me in to help with autopsies. And they would dig in, literally, and they would show me, okay, this is what happened, car accident. But how did this person die? This is an old person. They have obvious head trauma. Is that the cause of death? Or did they have a cardiac episode beforehand? And so they really went through all of the body systems, how they function, how they deteriorate, and then how they die, so that we could understand the actual cause of death, the sequence of this. And that was really cool. That really helped me on the ambulance. That helped me when I deployed to Iraq in 2003 as an Army medic on the back end of the invasion, attached to military police. And we would spend 15 months there. We'd be stationed everywhere from Nasiriyah to Diwaniyah. And then we'd run missions all through Baghdad. And then after our year, we thought we might go home, but they actually extended us, sent us to this little place called Abu Ghraib prison. Have you heard of that place?
Yes.
They told us, well, there was a unit there. They were having some difficulties. they're going to go where you were and you're going to replace them. But we didn't know that they were actually going to their court-martial investigation for torturing prisoners. And so a few weeks after being there, the whole scandal broke on the news, and we were like, oh my gosh, what is going on? And we had no idea that's why we were sent there. And then for the next 3 months, this kid from the cornfield saw people he had only ever seen on TV every day, whether it's the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, the reporters that you see on the news. Every time we searched or transported prisoners, there was an AP photographer just taking pictures of us, waiting for something to happen, shooting video. We would walk, you know, from one end of the base to the other to go to the chow hall or wherever we needed to go. And there'd be security set up and we had to go around because somebody was shooting a news hit. It was crazy. And by the time I got home from Iraq in July of 2004, two things had happened. One, the ambulance had gotten super boring. And two, I had missed my wedding by about 3 months. So I had to hurry up and get married.
Wow. What a story. What a journey. And I love that that you shared how important it is to understand how someone died, to really understand the human aspects of it, right? It's like, it's not just about what's to the life, but then also putting yourself or being in these very high danger zones in different countries, like you were mentioning earlier in Iraq, and then also seeing evidence and putting yourself obviously to see not only an experience, but also to really understand how all of this work and how everything is interconnected, the life, the deaths, and what we fight for and what we're striving to do, and then how do we individually fit in that circle. So with that in mind, I'm curious, obviously, after you served, you transition into something that I find very challenging for a lot of people that I talk to, specifically from when they're being in the military. You also transition very effectively to the civilian world and also start doing something that I think very few people are truly equipped to do well, which is that high level security. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I spent the next 2007 through 2010 as a security contractor in Iraq, which really helped being a private contractor in a government area. A lot of it was very familiar, but you had to produce value. You had to produce revenue. The bosses would ask you for things that the officers in the military would never ask you for. And so it kind of helped with that learning curve, understanding exactly what the difference between the public and private sector are. After that, I started doing executive protection in the United States. I ended up working for the Son of the King of Saudi Arabia in Northern Virginia, DC area. I was protecting his family. And that was also very interesting because we were a contracted executive protection service. So there was very real business value and contractual terms that we had to hit while maintaining good security for a family. And then it was a diplomatic family. So we were definitely on our own, full-on civilians, but we were still dealing with that government entity, right? The embassy, all of the different agencies that surround diplomatic families in the U.S. And during that year that I was there, the Iranians tried to assassinate the ambassador from Saudi to the U.S., who just lived down the street. And all of a sudden, I was in the middle of that international incident, talking with the embassy, talking with the FBI, State Department, everybody else trying to sort out this issue and try to keep everybody safe and make sure there were no impacts to the relationships to those countries, which was really interesting. And then I ended up transitioning to the State Department as an instructor teaching diplomats going to Iraq how to be safe, why security was important, and how they could interact with security programs in a way that actually helped facilitate their mission. So this is kind of where I started getting experience talking to executives about the business value of security programs, because diplomats, no matter what their level, they fancy themselves the boss, and they treat security like a service, which is very similar to the corporate environment. And to really understand how to facilitate their mission, you have to sell that value proposition. So I was doing that for 3 or 4 months, and then Benghazi happened. And the U.S. Congress, the Accountability and Review Board on Benghazi, looked at all of the training happening at the State Department, and they realized that there were 7 people, my team, we were the only ones actually attacking diplomats in training and teaching them what an attack felt like, what the role of security was during an attack, and how to survive and thrive in that environment. So we got grabbed by the review board, and they said, look, here's the white paper that we're going to be publishing, and we need you to redesign a program that checks off 98% of all of this training criteria. And so we did, and we fielded that program, and then we were on the news. So we had reporters coming through 60 Minutes. We'd take them through portions of the training so they could film it. They were talking with the bosses at the State Department about why this is necessary and how it's going to fix, you know, the tragedy that happened at Benghazi when we lost our ambassador. And that was super interesting, because now it's another international incident I'm involved in, but I'm kind of involved in the fixing of it and in that area. And then at the end of 2013, a buddy reached out to me and said, hey, have you ever thought about working at Facebook? And I said, no. What would I do at Facebook? Like, do you even know what I do? Like, hold on. I'll make it real simple for you. I teach one group of people how to get shot at correctly. I teach a second group of people how to shoot back correctly. And a third group of people how to patch up the first two groups of people who weren't so good at their jobs. What would I do there? And he said, well, we're redeveloping Mark's executive protection program, and I think you'd be a huge asset. So, you know, I'm going to give your resume to the guy that's hiring, and I just act like you don't want the job and like you don't really care. And I was like, well, I don't really think I want the job, and I don't really care. I've never thought about moving to California. It just doesn't sound great. So I got on the phone with this guy, and he's like, all right, Tim, how you doing? Tell me what you're doing. I said, well, do you want to hear what I actually do, or do you want to hear the cool guy story? And he laughs. He's like, tell me both, but the cool guy story first. I was like, all right, well, I'm a special tactics instructor, blah, 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 blah. I said, but, you know, actually, here's what I actually do. I have 100 diplomats a week, executives who don't care anything about security. I have 5 days to help them understand why security is important, how proper interactions can help facilitate their mission and good business outcomes, and then how to prepare and navigate the most dangerous, toughest situations they could ever experience in their life. And he said, when can you fly out? Because we have a company that's about a year post IPO. There's a lot of young leadership. There's a lot of young people throughout that company. And their investors are telling them, you have to professionalize your security department. They just don't know what that looks like there and how that fits in with their culture. And so in September of 2013, I moved out to Silicon Valley as a management level security consultant. And we started designing executive protection programs, and we started designing the customer service model that all of security would end up adopting at Facebook. And then, so that was 2013. In 2014, tragically, Sheryl Sandberg's husband died unexpectedly in a tragic manner. So we had to develop a security program for her in the wake of that. In 2015, I built their security technology and methods research and development lab. And then my last 6 years there, I built their anti-corporate espionage program. So if you're a nation state, or if you're a a competitor and you're trying to steal our information by any means other than hacking through the firewall, then that would come under my team. And so I manage that program globally until the end of 2022.
Wow, what a journey and what a tremendous results. And I love how you connected the dots, how everything is applicable right now. One thing in that I want to ask you also, obviously seeing how diplomatic worlds change and what we have the current state, who would ever thought that 2 years later, right now in 2024, we're seeing completely different landscape, what's happening in US and then also what's happening in the rest of the world. And from that risk, obviously, and crisis intervention and everything that both of us play quite a bit in different capacity. I'm curious, what do you see one of the biggest blind spots for Fortune 100 or even Fortune 500 and other companies that really are not prepared and ready?
So here's the interesting thing about me. I'm in security. That is my occupation, my industry. But the implementation of security is very tactical.
Yes.
So remember I told you that I grew up in healthcare, managed the morgue. So when I got to Facebook, let me paint this picture for you. In 2000, I graduated high school in the cornfield. In 2005, what happened? I bought my first computer ever because I needed to apply for a job back overseas in Iraq. In 2010, when I came home from Iraq, I bought my first smartphone and sent my very first text message, which seems crazy, but like you're not texting anybody when you're over in Iraq for like the last 4 years. And in 2013, I start building executive protection programs at Facebook and I become responsible for their technology. I know nothing about technology at this point in time. It makes no sense. Like, how would I get this job? And so I became convinced that I would be fired soon. And so if I was going to, you know, last at least for 6 months so I could find another job, I would just have to fake it until I make it. And so I started having all of these meetings with these super smart people. And I found a couple people that I could really depend on, people that I became friends with, and they really wanted to help produce good outcomes. And so I started talking about how technology works and why it's not working within the environment that we had. And as we started having these very friendly conversations, I started asking the same questions I would ask a patient. Like, hey, so what's the problem here? Like, why do you feel sick? What is your pain? And they would tell me all about the business pain. And then I'd be like, well, why do you think that's happening? Well, it could be this. It could be this. Over the next 6 to 8 months, I was able to define the ecosystem I was in at Facebook, just like the medical profession has defined the human body's ecosystem. And the medical assessment is nothing more than a root cause analysis. If you define the system that you're working with and you understand how to track symptoms, pain to root causes, then all of a sudden I started to see how things were dying. And so I became a premier project manager of technology projects at a Fortune 100 company, developing industry-leading technology applications and security. And I never, ever even messed with technology before in my life. Isn't that interesting? So if I'm going to take that same approach with my Fortune 100, AM Law 100 clients, I would tell you that the biggest oversight today is how corporate or firm culture contributes to the lack of effectiveness of their security programs. And how corporate or firm culture contributes to the breakdown in employee trust, all of these relationships, all coming back to leadership and how important it is to having a healthy organization.
I love that you came with fresh pair of eyes, with completely clean slate, in a way that you can also see things from very different perspective. And that's why I was, I'm sure, and with other factors, obviously, and other experience you brought in, tremendously successful, because we sometimes were just on autopilot. A lot of times we do things without even questioning why we're still doing them a certain way. But now the fact is that right now it's low time, the lowest time of leadership trust. It's like, yep. How do you really bridge the gap? Now we have a lowest leadership skill set for current and future type of leadership that is required because of environments that are changing, and they're not going to be the same. It's going to just be much more visible, right? And on top of it, the lack of trust, it's like, where do you go from here?
So I've been a student of leadership since about 2010. Because, you know, everybody has bad bosses, bad experiences with leadership. And I started to see how toxicity can build in the workplace or within teams. And I started to really take notes on the interactions I was a part of, because one, I knew I was going to be a leader someday. And I did not want to lead these toxic teams, right? So what could I do differently? And as I documented all of these interactions, all of the dynamics between leaders and managers and their teams, I started to find one common thread. Almost everybody leads based on their own fear and anxiety, their own need for self-preservation. And the people who don't have the teams that everybody's like, wow, I wish I had your team. Like, how do you recruit? You have the best people ever. And recruiting is super important. But far more important is a leader who intentionally banishes fear and anxiety from the team ecosystem and says, it will not exist here. We will not make decisions based on fear. If I see you doing it, I'm going to call it out and we're going to investigate. We're going to dive deeply into what is causing you to act irrationally. And when we get pressure from the top to do things that make no sense, I will be the roof and I will pick that battle and I will insulate you, my team, from the trauma, the fear-based trauma that we see in organizations across all industries, across the entire world. And it caused me to really ask this one question: in what world will you live, work, and lead? You need to decide. And that needs to be an intentional decision, because most leaders, they build their leadership philosophy while they're flying, right? While they're in progress, while they're dealing with all these pressures, these crises, the organizational pressures. And they make unintentional decisions in the moment. And once you start laying that track record, it's hard to stop, go back and say, oh, I'm going to switch how I do this without people losing trust in you. And so at the Kindness Games, we have started to talk about this leading with kindness philosophy and wrapping your head around the decisions that you need to make within your leadership journey before you're forced to make a decision. So that instead you can have North Stars that can guide you when you have that pressure and say, you know what, this may not work out well for me, but I'd rather risk losing this job than becoming the person I don't want to become.
I love how you tied kindness as an attitude, as an approach to leadership, because not only it's been proven over and over, specifically during the last 5 years, or specifically last 4 years when COVID occurred, how much compassion, kindness, and kindness-centered leadership and working environments, it's necessary when we're dealing with such a dramatic and different types of issues that we never dealt before in a modern time, right? And when you add some additional component to it, that changes not only how we show up, right, from our own standpoint, but how then also we help enact others to show up in the best possible version of themselves. So you also published the book, right? And if you don't mind sharing and tying this, what was the book about? And then how did you brought all these pieces together in such a great comprehensive way?
Yeah. So the book was not our idea. Here's the book, The Kindness Games by Lee Outen and Tim Wenzel. So here's a story around that. 2020, COVID happened, really screwed everything up. I continued to travel while nobody was traveling. I would take flights to Hawaii. I would take flights to other countries, and there'd be like six other people on the entire flight. I would walk into San Francisco's international terminal, and it would be me and whatever TSA agent was roaming and the gate agent or the check-in agent at the desk. I believe it was May of 2020, I did my first 2-week quarantine in a hotel, and I was actually super excited about it because life at home was not great. The reason it was not great is I told you earlier that my wife and I, we do foster care, right? Well, the week before the lockdowns happened, my wife took a 5-day-old out of the maternity ward and a 3-month-old who had just suffered a head trauma. And so we had 2 crying age babies in a 2-bedroom apartment when all of a sudden I had to work from home. Imagine the chaos. You know, my wife kept them in like separate bedrooms on either side. She was trying to keep them fed and changed and happy. In the meantime, I'm in the living room on Zoom talking with executives and doing all of these interesting things. And so it was just super chaotic. So I was actually looking forward to this 2-week quarantine in the hotel. I was going to get some sleep. I was going to be super productive. And unfortunately, during that quarantine, George Floyd was murdered. Mm-hmm. And I watched that over and over and over again. You couldn't break away from it. And it just really, you know, it was disappointing because it was a time that should have brought us all together. Everybody was unified in their outrage. Everybody was unified in like, this should not have happened. We just need to be thoughtful. And yet, all of our news media, all of our leaders, instead, they drove wedges and they pulled us apart. And so by the time I was on my second 2-week hotel quarantine in September of 2020, when I walked into that room, turn on the TV, I just saw the riots at the Portland courthouse. I changed the channel and it's news commentators and political figures saying, hey, if you look like this, if you think like this, if you believe in these things, then here are the people you have to hate because they hate you and they want to destroy you. And I was like, really? Because I'm a kid from the cornfield that spent my entire 20s in the Middle East, surrounded by people that I should hate because they attacked my country, and Western philosophy and culture and Middle Eastern philosophy and culture don't really have anything in common. There's a lot of places to where they're at odds. And yet I absolutely love Middle Eastern culture and the people are amazing and they love me. And so I don't believe that just because you seemingly have different beliefs or nothing in common doesn't mean that you have to hate each other. Mm. And I thought it was pretty obvious that we got over that, like at the turn of the century, right? Like in the 60s, we fought pretty hard to get over like that whole idea of people look different, so we have to treat them different and hate them. And so to see this coming back, it was just disgusting to me. So I started feeling depressed for the first time in my life in September of 2020. So I reached out to my buddy Lee Outen and I said, look, man, I'm suffering. I've got 2 weeks in this room. I feel the darkness settling in. I've never felt this before. And I just don't know what kind of mindset I'm going to be when I get out of here. And I still have like 3 weeks of work to do before I can go home, right? 2 weeks is just the beginning. And I said, I feel like we're in an ideological Hunger Games. I feel like we're being forced to fight for the benefit and the pleasure of those who are above us, the elites, the people in control. And it has nothing to do with us. So I want to focus on positivity. I want to give a shout out one a day for 30 days to somebody who's doing something good. Let's find out if we know people that are hurting, who are struggling mentally through this, that we know. And let's talk about the amazing things they do. Let's lift them up for the world to see instead of tearing each other down. And so he and I started doing that. By the time I got home, it was a month later, and we're just finishing up our 30 days. And there were three other people who were about a week away from finishing their 30 days. But there were like 20 some other people that started doing it, which was kind of mind blowing to us because we didn't think this would start anything. We just were trying to keep me mentally strong. Fast forward to New Year's Eve 2021. I'm posting a video of me and Janina Linka, who lives in London, becoming our 19th alumni, the 19th person to finish this challenge. And we had a couple hundred people globally participating in some level. And then by the time September came back around and we had finished a year, someone on every continent in the world except for Antarctica had finished our challenge.
Wow.
And so the people that finished the challenge, the alumni from that first year, they said, we should write a book. And we were like, nah, I don't think so. I don't write books. I actually don't like to write. I don't know anybody that publishes books or writes books or anything like this. And so we said, if you want to do this, then you guys figure it out. So we thought we shut that down. Then they came back and said, well, we've been talking to people and we have to have a manuscript. So, well, again, I don't write books. So let's just have everybody write a chapter. And so we had 17 chapters that got written by, you know, 17 people that had done this. And then we said, okay, well, I don't have money that my wife is going to let me put into making a book, getting it published. It probably won't sell. So find a publisher that will do it for free. And they did. And so we kept trying to shut this down and it kept coming back. And so by the time 2022 comes around, the publisher says, here's the layout and there's gaps. So Tim and Lee, you have to write transition chapters, figure out what you want to talk about. We're like, okay, you know, maybe over the next couple of years we can do this. And they were like, no, like this has to be done pretty quickly. Well, we're busy. But then I got laid off at the end of 2022 in the first round of tech layoffs. And so I had time to write those chapters. And so around March of 2023, the manuscript was finished. And in November of 2023, the book debuted on Barnes & Noble's and Amazon.
What a great story. And I love, it's so intriguing because obviously the game of kindness, you know, the kindness games. And it just, I love what you said earlier, how that felt the moment of Hunger Games during the COVID and a shift and how that affected you because you for first time recognizing different symptoms and what's going on with yourself personally. And then it's like, what can I do proactively, but also what can I do to help others? And I love how this disruptive year shaped it so much, which is ironic because during that disruptive year, I also launched Legacy Leader Show because I was overcoming long healing from COVID and I was literally not having enough energy. I'm like once a week to do conversation and the reason I'm bringing this up is how amazing stuff spent from there and look at where things are today. And for everybody that is eager to learn more, what is the, obviously, the kindness game all about? Is that basically applicable in business, on individual, familiar with family members? How would you portray the Hunger Game? I'm sorry, the kindness games of switching from the Hunger Games into really day-to-day life, because one thing I learned, and took me a while to really understand early on, I thought everybody's being born with amplified kindness within themselves, till I had a Dalai Lama to tell me that actually kindness is taught and has to be instilled. And just because I was the lucky one that had that with my upbringing, not everybody, even in our society here in the United States, have that foundation. So please tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would love to tell you that in 2021 and 2022, we fixed this, but look at the news. We're still in an ideological Hunger Games. We are still being driven apart, divided by people who have a need to have a grip on power, which is really unfortunate. So the kindness games is still a game that people are playing. We have a gentleman from the UK who's playing right now. We have a couple other people playing. And we've noticed that when things are not going well in the world, when layoffs are happening, when there's uncertainty around war, when all these things happen, people start playing the game. And when things are good, people stop playing the game. And so the game is there when you need it. It's mm-hmm. there to pick you up, to refocus your mental health on positivity. And here's the thing. When you start to express gratitude on a daily basis for a month, you reprogram your perception of the world around you. You start to see when people are upset, when they're introducing toxicity, when they're struggling, when they're hurt. And instead of reacting to it in a way that's like, oh, I have to protect myself, you start to ask, what's going on there and how can I help? Mm-hmm. You start to see the opportunity to infuse goodness and kindness in your sphere of influence. So that's what the game is. The kindness games in 2021, we started having companies come to us and say, do you do employee engagement programs? We have employees working remote and they are so disengaged. There are some employees that won't even respond to like our emails to say, are you okay? They only just do their work. And then they start asking, do you do leadership programs? Do you do all of these types of programs? And I'm like, of course, doesn't everybody? You can just Google this stuff, right? But it forced us to really start to figure out, what does kindness mean everywhere in the world and in corporate culture? So one, we redefined what kindness is. Kindness is not being nice. Those are separate words. Those are completely separate ideas. The whole idea of being nice, really what that is it is making up your mind for a social engagement or a work engagement to say, I will not do anything disruptive. I will go out of my way, even sacrifice myself for the experience of others. And there's times when that is a good way to navigate certain scenarios and environments and opportunities, right? There is definitely a place for being nice, but kindness has nothing to do with that. Kindness, as we define it, is the endeavor to recognize the humans on the other side of every situation in life with the intention to create the best outcome for them, as much as it is within our power. So even if you're a police officer and you have to arrest people, like, that's not a good outcome for them, right? That's actually like a bad interaction. But after that is safe, after they're in the back of your squad car, you can ask them if they're okay. You can have a conversation about an unrelated topic. You can make sure you get them some snacks, some water. You can make sure that they retain their dignity. And that is kindness, even though they're in a really bad situation, right? When your boss takes your idea in the meeting and tells everybody it was their idea, there's a way to navigate that situation that is, one, strong, and two, doesn't cause further toxicity. And so we created some leading with kindness values. The first value is our common humanity. We believe that we can define humanity across every culture in the world, possibly throughout all time periods on this earth, in this idea that we all have high aspirations and dreams for ourselves, and we all fail to meet them. Universally, we disappoint. So why are we shocked and outraged when we disappoint each other? That is our common humanity. And, you know, on the surface, it sounds kind of dark, but actually there's a beauty in understanding that if we embodied and championed the fact that we are all at some point going to let each other down, then how will we help each other through those letdowns? Mm-hmm. So the next one is curiosity leads to self-control. When somebody comes after you, when they accuse you of something, when they ambush you in that meeting, when they make false accusations, that causes us to get hyped up, right? It causes that fight or flight in our brain. We start to get very defensive. Our blood pressure rises. Our pulse starts to beat. We get flushed. And we end up saying things and doing things that later we regret. We hate that we said that thing and acted that way. And we wish we could have done it better. And so curiosity in those moments, asking one or two or three questions, simple questions like, I had no idea that I made you feel that way. Can you help me understand exactly when that happened and what we were talking about? And even though right there in that moment, like, you're amped up, you've asked a question, you've made them engage their logical faculties, and now you have time to breathe and calm down and listen. And when they explain that to you, then you can say, oh, okay, I see where you're coming from, but that wasn't my intent. I intended for this X, Y, and Z. How could I have done that better so that I could relay that message to you appropriately? And then ask a third question after they answer that. And pretty soon you're doing a couple things. One, you're de-escalating everything. Two, you're actually gaining information rather than just responding to an attack or an unexpected feedback. You're gaining information that you can action, and you can develop that relationship, and you can get past this problem. But if you just say, Tim, you're the worst, and I'm like, you're the worst, I hate you, I hate every time you walk into the room, you make me feel like this, that doesn't do any good. The next is mindfulness and purpose. So what is my purpose for this moment, for me and for everyone else in this situation? One of the things that I often say, if you know me, you know I have like a pretty decently big personality. I can have enough fun for everybody in an entire room. Like, if I show up for something I'm excited about, I can have all the fun, push everybody to the walls. And actually, I've been told, like, hey, dude, like, I'm glad you had a good time, but you kind of stole everybody else's experience. The opposite is also true. Those things that we are afraid of, that performance conversation, the things that we dread, that person that we just have to work with, and it just always goes wrong, right? We always leave so angry. What do? We hope. We hope that it goes better. But it will never go better if we just hope. Instead, we can understand, why am I here? What do I need for me? And what do they need? And we can try to navigate that situation with mindfulness and purpose. And every time we ask ourselves those questions and we cocktail napkin design that interaction, and then we learn more the next time we interact, we do the same thing. Pretty soon you'll find that you're having really good interactions with people you used to hate, because you're also trying to figure out how to serve them. Grace and acceptance. So if we know that we're serial disappointers, other than malicious intent, if somebody is malicious towards you, they're trying to hurt you, they're, you know, trying to do you damage, that's different. That that you have to do disciplinary action. You have to meet that head on, but just mistakes, like people messing up, people aiming for here and landing here. Why don't we extend them some grace? Because we've been there too, and we'll probably be there again next week. Accept that we're both human and forge a relationship and a path forward to help them learn from their mistakes, bring them back into a non-judgmental relationship, and move forward as people, as common humans, right? People that have to live and work together. After you get past that, the fifth is assuming best intent in others.
Yes.
How often do you send an email and somebody gets irate with you and you're like, what happened? We don't communicate very well virtually. Most of us don't communicate very well in person. And so when somebody attacks us or we feel like we're attacked, why don't we just assume that they didn't mean to attack us? There's a really easy way to do this. We can say like, Isabella, that note you sent me, it felt like you were insinuating this. But you know what? I know you. I don't think that's where you're going. And even though it hurt me in the moment, like, I would love to know what you actually meant. Now, two things. One, most of the time we hurt each other unintentionally. Earlier this year, I had a coworker who I'd never met in person. We'd only worked virtually. And he called me up and he let me have it for like 30 minutes on like how terrible of a person I am, how bad of a leader I am, how toxic I am to the team. And I was like, wow, that kind of goes against everything I believe in and try to push into this world. And so I let him talk it out and I asked him questions and I realized that I had written and said some hurtful things, but I didn't intend them to be hurtful. They were just received wrong. So if it was on accident and you tell somebody, hey, you made me feel this way, they'd be like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that. But then there's another group of people. There's a technical term for them. We call them dicks. Like people that just, they want to mess with people. If you did that same approach with somebody who meant to hurt you, hey, you made me feel this way. I was hurt, but I don't think you meant to do that. Most of them don't have the courage to actually say, no, I meant to do it that way, because that would hurt them. Right? They're going back into self-preservation mode.
Yes.
And they'll say like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I really meant to. Okay. So now this is an interesting thing, right? Some people will be like, but you're supposed to get that person. They're evil. They do this to everybody. But yeah, you let them have their dignity while you call them out on their crap.
It's also, I love the approach, how you with kindness can still address very difficult, challenging situation. And I cannot agree with you in terms of communication, just that flat out, doesn't matter if it's in person, in writing, or it's virtual, however we do it, communication is, again, to me, essential skill, not a soft skill, and also skill that it's not being thought, not even remotely enough. And as a result, we have all these issues, right? And then things can quickly escalate, and more than anybody knows what escalation does. But I'm really thrilled that you walk us through that, because it's a great reminder. It's a great opportunity also to pause and think about it. Am I following all the steps? What I'm missing? And how am I leading? How can I improve my leadership? How can I be better? And how am I perceived, how everybody sees me versus how I think they do? Very, very, very big difference could be often for a lot of leaders that we can see today, right?
Absolutely. And you'll see that those tenets that we're talking about of leading with kindness, it's not rolling over and letting people hurt you. It's actually showing strength in these situations, but just doing it in a way that doesn't incur further damage on relationships, which I think is really important.
Absolutely. And that instills the trust, that instills also open door policy that people can come in and raise the issues, things that we can prevent. And obviously both of us know what being proactive and preventative type of leader or a situation or working environment versus reactive crisis and emergencies and things that obviously we know how far and how quickly that can go in many different directions. And I love what you said earlier in your sharing, how important it is for you not to always be the one who is cleaning the messes. Because both of us had a plenty of that to do. And it's like, if we teach and we instill the foundation and give the frameworks in environment, then it's less of messes to be clean, because that's always more difficult. That's already too late. That's already trust broken. That's already damage being made. And how do you now switch and come back out of it or repair either situation and environment? It's not only costing a lot of money and time and effort, but obviously costing people's lives. With all of that that is being shared so far, Tim, I'm curious now, what is in your bucket list? I mean, you lived such an amazing life. I can tell you, very rich and beautiful. And I love what you and your wife are doing and fostering children and helping on top of everything. And I know how these schedules are so demanding. So not only you led and lived your legacy, already left your legacy in so many different sectors and companies and environments, but now it's like, what's in the bucket list? And what would you like at this chapter of your life, your legacy to be?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for asking. So my number one bucket list item, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of adventures to have, life experiences to have. I am currently every year speaking on about 20 stages, and that's increasing. I'm starting to get paid to do keynotes all around the world, which is fantastic. That's actually where I would love to take my career, get out of security as a career and get into helping people lead better and think about life in a more sustainable fashion. But if I had to say, like, I had my top bucket list item, it is, I want to live for the watchers. So we have people around us that look to us to understand how to live. We have children that we're raising. Maybe you don't have your own kids, but you have a niece or a nephew. Yes. Or you lives down the street who just like, hey, I love this guy. I talk to him every time I see them. They're watching how you talk to your spouse. They're watching how you talk to that waiter or waitress. They're watching how you manage your anger and when you should be angry and yet you're not. There are all sorts of people who are watching us to learn how to live well, and they've never asked for permission. And so some people will say, well, that's not my problem. And then that's why we have the Hunger Games, the ideological Hunger Games that we're doing. Now, we close our book with this question. Someone once asked me, are leaders responsible for how people perceive and experience them? This conversation was about people who didn't want to get along with others, people who seem to want to be unhappy, people, you know, people like this. And this question was meant to point out the fact that no matter our intentions, no matter how amazing we are, we can't always get everyone aligned. Some people don't want to join the culture we're building or follow the vision that we're casting. Some people will always choose not to understand, will always choose to mock, to point out our faults or the exceptions to the rule, which somehow invalidate the rest of the evidence we're building our initiative upon. Some people will never have a day of fun in their entire life because they choose it. And they also wish it upon others. But I say yes. We are absolutely responsible for how people perceive and experience us. This is a journey that's worth the struggle. And later on in this closing chapter, I talk about we need to dedicate ourselves to as best as we can, right? Remember our common humanity. I want to provide this experience to everybody I interact with, even though I'm going to provide a lot of experiences down here. But I endeavor to provide that experience, not because I want people to like me, but because I want to be instructive to everyone who looks to me. And after that experience I'm providing, I am not responsible for what they think of me, what they say about me, the stories that they tell, the things that, you know, they want other people to believe. That's on them. Because when you live for others, when you don't live for yourself, people can spread all the lies that they want, but everybody can see what's actually going on. And when you live in that manner, when you make mistakes, when you stumble and fall, people will extend you grace and they'll accept you and they'll help you get back up.
Thank you for listening to Legacy Leader Show. If you enjoyed the content and had a positive experience, then please leave us a positive rating. In addition, leave us positive review whenever you are listening on whatever platform there might be. Make sure your friends and family also know about the benefit and value that we provide and what we have to offer. Cheers.